So about 3 years ago, a friend of mine named Brian Fry, some of you might know him, he leads, kind of gives leadership across North America on collegiate church planting. He says, every year I'm gonna make one ask of you, and just so you know, I'm not taking this lightly. When I make that ask, I want you to really seriously consider it. And so one year he says, Jeff, would you fly to Oakland and meet Ed Kang and his staff? And so in my mind, I said, all right. So I made arrangements to go to Berkeley and meet Ed and Kelly and his staff. And you know, your mind is, okay, I know this is going to be a significant church. And I know that this is going to, you know, this is going to be worth my time. But in my mind, I was sort of expecting going into a church building, finding a boardroom table and meeting with the staff. And I discovered that wasn't what it was going to be at all. I was going into an auditorium, and I was going to be speaking to, at that time, 1,050 people in his staff. And I was not prepared for that. And then afterwards, I was invited to go and be in some of their missional communities, their small groups that they're having as they're doing disciple making, and began to watch the level of Christ-likeness of the church and the level of sacrifice of the average church member. And I just joked with Ed. I go, I think when I was there, I go, I don't even think I'm saved when I was hanging around and seeing the level of devotion to Jesus in this church. It was just absolutely phenomenal. So I promise you that these next minutes that you have here, I'm just going to ask you, because when we were praying, you remember we had a time of prayer for, you know, the harvest is plentiful, but laborers are few. A lot of times when we are praying, I don't know if we're really, really looking at who the potential harvesters are. I think sometimes we miss that. And perhaps when you hear Ed's story and hear what's about to happen, maybe you're going to have some fresh eyes at who the harvesters might be and a movement that's about to come. So, Ed, would you come? I'm just going to pray, and then I'll just hand you this mic, and you run away with it. Not with Father, Lord, I thank you for this time, and I thank you for this man, and I thank you for Kelly, this family, and I thank you for you taking an attorney and an engineer and unleashing a movement like I've never seen. And I just pray, Father, as he would share, you would just guide him and you would guide us, guide our hearts. Help us to hear what you want us to hear. Help us to see what church could be. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
Amen. Thank you, Jeff, for those amazing words. Man, I'm just humbled and intimidated by this crowd. I think this is probably going to be my one claim to fame for a while, that I get to address like the leaders of, Jeff said, 3/4 of the church planting in North America happens under your influence, something like that. So this is exciting. And I guess as a local church pastor, and that's who I am still, I don't have any other titles than that. I guess in some ways, I just, I don't know, you know, I'm sort of making things up as I go along, and it's not very systematic, and, you know, you don't really study yourself. I'm just trying to, like, survive the weekend, and so it was kind of a neat experience having Brian Fry and then Jeff come and, you know, like, ask us questions, and we had to kind of come up with answers to these questions that nobody else ever asks, and so I've... So I figured out that we're kind of a church planting. I don't know if we're a network. We don't call ourselves that, but we're a collegiate church planting network. I guess that's who we are. I've been at this church for 30 years, going on 31 years. Started as a lay leader and full-time capacity since 93. And Our vision is an Acts 2 church in every college town. And, you know, that wasn't always our vision. So I'll tell you a little bit about our kind of quirky story. But in 2007, we wanted to revamp our website and said, we got to have a vision statement. All the cool websites have a vision statement. And not to make fun of any of yours, but I had like a three-part, like something with God and something with man and something with self, something like that. And then one day somebody from the back said, how about an Acts 2 church in every college town? And I remember a lump in my throat, and I remember like people couldn't speak for a while because we realized, no, that's who we are. We're seized by it immediately. And we started church planting in a big way starting from 2007. We're at 18 cities, reaching 34 campuses now. And the way we do it is we send out teams of something like 10 to 20 of our own people who know each other well, you know, went through college together. They all get jobs in these new cities, and they all kind of move en masse. And they're all homegrown, and we fund all of our own church planting internally because I had no idea there was money available. So we fund it all internally, and that hasn't been a problem. So because we're a collegiate church, we need to explain ourselves to our freshmen. So every couple of years, we make a video that sort of explains our story. So this past Thanksgiving retreat, which was last weekend, we made a video. So I just want to show you this video. I think after a long day, well, it's only 8 minutes, so it's not very entertaining, but it does sort of capture our story and who we are. So let's roll that video.
An Acts 2 church in every college town. That's the vision that drives a lot of what we do as a church. But where did that vision come from? In the final verses of Acts chapter 2, we find a compelling picture of the early church. Acts 2 describes a group of believers who built their lives around the church community. They devoted themselves to teaching, fellowship, prayer. They met each other on a daily basis, breaking bread and going in and out of each other's homes. They were a family. They even sold their own possessions to help each other, and the Lord added to their numbers those who were being saved. It's an inspiring picture, but that was 2,000 years ago. Could that actually happen today? A church that is meeting in each other's homes and eating there day by day? That seems hard when today's church is often thought of as a once-a-week, one-or-two-hour sort of thing. And besides, whose home are you going to meet at? And a church where people freely share their possessions? Nobody actually does that outside their own family. In the 21st century, the Acts 2 church sounds too good to be true. But the amazing thing is that over the past 30 years, somehow we have come to experience Acts chapter 2. Like so many things in life, it happened in an unexpected way. It all started when we were college students at UC Berkeley. We experienced being in each other's homes, eating together, hanging out almost every day. Did we discover some secret principle of community? No, we were just going to college. What we didn't anticipate back then was that college life provided the template to live out Acts chapter 2. So you might say we were an accident of history, people trying to follow God who met each other at a point in life when we can experience the closest thing to Acts 2. We all lived in tiny dorms or in apartments near each other. We got close through cramming for midterms, sharing energy drinks and snacks late into the night, maybe to the detriment of our bodies. We bonded over our common identity as students, just trying to survive in college. In short, we shared life together, and there was a dailiness to it all. And as we followed God, we became close as a family. We saw our friends getting saved and their lives getting transformed, and we got excited thinking about what God could do in and through our lives. When graduation came, we all expected for the dream to end, that we'd just move on to our careers and families. That was how it usually goes. But some of us asked, why should this end? Why do we have to separate? What if instead of scattering to chase the American dream, we continue to live in community, just like we did in college? What if we continue to live close enough to borrow sugar or milk or even a meal? Okay, well, that's not really borrowing. What if instead of thinking about my future and my spiritual aspirations, we thought about our future, of what we can build together for the kingdom of God? And that's what we decided to do. I guess you could say we were just a bunch of people who enjoyed college life so much that we never left it. When we started working, we didn't want things like career and income to intrude on our relationships, so we continued to keep our lives simple. There were tough times, of course. We had to push back on the pull to just follow the higher paying job or the nicer home, but we stuck together. We stuck to God's word. We kept up the meeting in each other's homes day by day part. And over the next 2 decades, we got to experience God adding to our number daily those who are being saved. College students were coming to Christ, getting baptized and discipled. Over time, some of the students we met and ministered to decided to stick around after graduation to keep reaching out to the Berkeley campus. With each graduating class, more people caught the vision of being the Acts 2 church together. And as time went on, God led us beyond the college campus as well. We started serving the elderly by bringing church to their nursing homes. This became what is known today as elderly care ministry. We discovered a number of local churches without the resources to put on service for their youth. And so we began forming teams to partner with those churches and meet that need. This became our Inner High ministry. On our campus, we started bringing the gospel to the growing number of international students, many of whom had never heard the gospel or read the Bible. At the heart of our church remains the desire to reach the college campus. After all, it was the place where so many of us had encountered Jesus. We began to realize that the Acts 2 church we were experiencing was more than just a pleasant surprise to be enjoyed with one another on our own campus. It was something we needed to replicate on other campuses as well. And so the vision was born, an Acts 2 church, not just in Berkeley, but in every college town. And for the past 12 years, that's what we've been doing. Anywhere from 10 to 20 of us throwing in our lots together and moving to the next church plant destination, we packed up our belongings, found new jobs, and relocated our families. Each time, it was sad to say goodbye. But we felt convicted that the gospel that saved us must continue to go through us. We've come to just see how pivotal a mission field the college campus is. The campus culture is saturated with unspoken expectations of how to live life, how to have fun, how to deal with stress, how to do college, and none of those involved pursuing Christ. And yet college is also the place where the trajectories of our lives are set. We realized that there's a spiritual battle for the lives of over 21 million college students across our nation. The harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few. So we went as God led us. As we look back on the past 12 years, God has used us to plant 18 churches serving 34 college campuses. 385 church planters have been sent out. We're bringing Sunday services to 38 nursing homes. We serve 75 Inner High churches in 45 cities to minister to over 600 youth. Most amazing of all, we have led 4,300 people to repent and surrender their lives to Jesus. Our church today looks much different from the group of friends who stuck together after graduation and committed their lives to God some 30 years ago. But what does remain the same is that DNA, the template of college life, continuing in the lives of the next generation of campus ministers and church planners striving to live out the vision of Acts 2. And as we look back, we marvel at how God has led us from a small band of college friends just wanting to spend some time together to a church that God would use to reach others who need the gospel to the ends of the earth. And they devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and the fellowship, to the breaking of bread and the prayers. And awe came upon every soul, and all who believed were together and had all things in common. And they were selling their possessions and belongings and distributing the proceeds to all, as any had need. And day by day, breaking bread in their homes, they received their food with glad and generous hearts. And the Lord added to their number day by day those were being saved.
Okay, so I have slides. Not exciting, just a Bible text. That's exciting. So this is a passage that obviously the video mentioned a couple of times that captured our hearts, and I guess that's what we mean by an Acts 2 church. And of course, every phrase probably deserves lengthy lingering and sermons. But just the point that we the point that I want to emphasize is that the college campus life patterns give you a template for making an Acts 2 type of rhythm possible today. So you read this, and it's like, oh, is this possible in this day and age? And I think I was reading David Brooks' book, Second Mountain, big chunks of it on the flight over, actually. And I don't know if you've heard of that book. It's his newest book, and David Brooks is somebody. I read all of his books. He talks about isolation as a result of hyper-individualism in Western societies. And, you know, I know a lot of you guys like to say, oh, we in the West are like this, but the global church isn't. And I know a little bit about Asia. It's just as hyper-individualistic. And I think we beat ourselves up over, you know, the rise of the nuns and the, you know, people leaving our churches. But millennials and Generation Z, they're just leaving everything. You know, they're disaffiliating with everything. And in that book, he makes the observation that if somebody went to a neighbor's house at 8:30 p.m. unannounced, that would be considered a colossal, like, invasion of privacy. And then he follows it up with this. It says, in America, we have exchanged community for privacy. And in the church world, that's, you know, often not too different, where we might not know what anybody else is doing throughout the week. And the phrase that from this text that jumps out at me is day by day. Like, they were literally meeting daily. And on a typical college campus, people just do that. They take classes together. You know, they live within, like, maybe 10 square blocks is where everybody's crowded, and you're naturally bumping into each other, shouting at friends across the campus. And so it's not that we're very spiritual or really even appreciated this passage. You know, we're just, like the video said, we enjoyed college life, and one day decided, hey, let's stay around to pour into our campus, because this is where we got saved. And then as we're living like that, we said, well, why don't we live close together, you know, so that we can hang out all the time. And then one day we discovered, lo and behold, we're imitating the Acts 2 church, you know, maybe not in its spirituality, but at least in its social patterns. You know, we're in each other's homes, and especially the breaking of bread part. So typically after college, though, I think probably a lot of you experienced this kind of life when you were in college. I notice a lot of pastors, they're part of crew or inner varsity and have fond memories of those times. But what happens is right after college, you know, you sort of head out there because, of course, your preparatory time is done, you know, and sort of that's the final starting block from which you launch your life out there to whatever, you know, either the American dream or sometimes even your best understanding at that season of life of God's calling. And it's a very individualistic kind of idea where I'm going to go out there and I'm going to make my mark in the world. And then right around 30, then you kind of look back and you say, well, where did all my friends go? You know, and I'm speaking to a room mostly full of men. This is apparently truer of men than women. Women keep making friends throughout every season of life, but apparently guys make all their friends in college and then you just slowly lose them, you know? And the last time you had a bunch of guys you were really real with and felt, you know, totally comfortable, maybe was college. And that's often the case. There's a book that means a lot to us called Refrigerator Rights, in which the writer talks about that level of relationship where you can go to somebody's house and you can go to the refrigerator and take stuff out and you know, pick up a drink or whatever without asking for permission. So that kind of relationship, refrigerator rights relationship. And again, the last time people enjoyed that with any number of people probably tended to be in college. So when we decided that we're going to stay together, so there's already the college pattern of close proximity, close bonding, the sort of things that separate people or kind of create distance between people, they get somehow muted during college, like difference in wealth or whatever. You know, we're all stressed out by the same exams. And so when we laid on top of our college patterns a spiritual vision, then that became very powerful. And since our vision started to converge, not around any fancy doctrine or but really around the kind of Christian community that we wanted to retain and then eventually duplicate, then that meant that we had to covenant with each other to stay together. Because it wasn't my dream, it was our dream. And if one of us left, then like you're kind of taking a part of the dream with you. And so we've staying together was not without its costs in terms of career opportunities or even better graduate schools. But as layers and layers of people started doing this, it became kind of part of our culture. And people did stay together. And to me, that makes all kinds of sense. Because if you say that, you know, I'm Christ-centered and my life is all about the gospel, and yet in the major decisions of life, such as what kind of job I'm going to take and where I'm going to move to, well, that's all based on criteria. That has nothing to do with. To me, that doesn't make sense. I think, so I remember a conversation with somebody who was criticizing me and our church for keeping people too much. You know, you should let them go. So where should I let them go? And I heard this guy got into Harvard, or this person got a job at Goldman Sachs in New York, and they're taking a lesser job or turning down that. And then he said something. He said, because aren't there good churches anywhere? Like, aren't there good churches everywhere? Like, they can just go find a good church, right? And I mean, like, what was I going to say? Like, no, right? Of course there are good churches everywhere, I guess. But then aren't there good jobs everywhere, right? And that's such a low view of church that you can just decide your life based on any number of criteria, conventionally defined as good, upwardly mobile criteria, and then you'll just sort of tack on your church because it's just a place I go to, right? So I go to a good church. And that it checks off that box. And I think that's a low view of church in the sense that it's a low view of, like, what can happen when people covenant with each other relationally and keep that up, you know? And so it was interesting because I think Patrick, as well as Danae, talked about relationships being everything. And relationships involve place. We're embodied beings. There has to be a commitment to place as well as to people. And so we started doing that and experienced that level of closeness and that kind of Acts 2-like church life did not have to be limited to college. So I should have said this earlier, but I'm going to walk through some passages through the book of Acts. In order to frame my talk. So I know there's a bit of a rough transition here, but the next passage is from Acts chapter 4. There was not a needy person among them, for as many as were owners of lands or houses sold them and brought the proceeds of what was sold and laid it at the apostles' feet, and it was distributed to each as any had need. Thus Joseph, who was also called by the apostles Barnabas, which means son of encouragement, a Levite, a native of Cyprus, sold a field that belonged to him and brought the money and laid it at the apostles' feet. I think this is sort of the issue of leadership, like who gets to be a leader or how are the leadership paths determined? And I think somehow early on it made sense to us to make leadership criteria not necessarily by gifting or competence. As a result of which, a lot of our leaders lack leadership qualities. So that's kind of a problem too. So I'm not saying that's great, but we decided it should be by sacrifice. It should be by sacrifice. And Barnabas was recognized for his sacrifice to meet the needs, and people like him to such an extent that a statement like there is not a needy person among them, that really inspires me. So we have a lot of leaders with who aren't natural like big personality leaders, but who led the way in sacrifice early on in choosing to stay, which was a bigger drama than Northern California and Southern California being what it is today. You might not appreciate that, but back in the early days, Northern California was like mostly orchards, and you know, SoCal is where it was at, and most of us had come from there. So not going back disappointed our parents. And so people who made that kind of sacrifice, people continue to make sacrifices in terms of time with their family, in terms of finances, in terms of sleep, because for college students, like midnight is early evening. So our leaders are leaders because they've got wounds, and they've sacrificed, and they continue to do so. And I think defining leadership based on gifting, I think, is too narrow. I think it defines it ends up defining ministry in a narrow way. Like real ministry is what gifted individuals can do, and then everybody comes around. That individual supports it, leverages it across multiple venues, let's say, or something like that. And for us, we want, like, because our vision is a certain type of church with a certain relational vibe to it, we want everybody engaged in ministry. And if we want everybody engaged in ministry, willingness, I think, makes more sense as the key, willingness to sacrifice time and energy. And I think that's democratic. You know, everybody can sacrifice. You know, not everybody's gifted. So, and again, that's sort of in hindsight. Like, it's not something that we had kind of a perspective on early on. But it turns out that, you know, that's sort of how we ended up deciding on leaders. And then the next... next move in the early church story that has some relevance to us is from chapter 6. It's the famous incident of poor administration by the apostles, and in good leadership fashion, they gather the whole church and admit that it's their problem, that they're wrong, and then they say, let's pick seven guys and let's appoint them to this task. And it's interesting that you don't see any of these seven guys doing any of that actually afterwards, but because they don't get to, you know, the church gets scattered, and that's the next point. But I call this sort of, if we sort of abstract this to internal problems of growth, for us it hit us in this way, as people were graduating and staying, and that's not typical of college ministries, but in Berkeley, we retained something like 90% of our graduates. System-wide, I had to ask people to tally this up. We retain about 70% of our graduates. So when the college students graduate, they choose to stay. Now, college ministry isn't for everybody. So for whatever reason, some of those people who stay gets... involved back into the college ministry, and then some of them don't. So we have a problem because we can't have like half of the postgraduate part of our church, you know, doing flat out ministry, going to college campus, sitting down with college students across the dining hall and engaging them in spiritual conversations and staying out late doing that, and then the other half be idle, right? So And we wanted everybody to be engaged in some kind of gospel ministry. We wanted everybody to share the gospel, use their energies and time to pour into some people. And so we've had to develop these ministries that the video briefly mentioned. And I think it's not so much because we had a huge heart for these ministries, although we did, but it was really a kind of a pastoral concern of our post-college people who grew up at our church and got discipled through their college time and really wanted to serve in some way. And for whatever reason, they weren't suited for college ministry. And so we developed a ministry called Impact, which is a nonprofit where we go to Oakland and we pick the worst performing elementary school in Oakland, which at that time was Garfield, and we're still at Garfield. And we provide academic enrichment programs for the kids, and then we give them a meal, and then we invite them for our Christian programming. We've also developed a ministry. Oh, I wanted to show a video clip at this point. So I'm going to show you a Lord of the Rings video clip because I think I'm doing kind of okay on time. So I don't know if you guys are Lord of the Rings fans. Somebody asked Tim Keller, like, how many times have you read Lord of the Rings? And apparently his answer was, I never stopped. So I'm trying to be like him. And this is a one-minute clip, so don't get excited. It'll be over. It's nothing exciting, but this is relevant to what I'm talking about. So let's roll that clip.
We must ride light and swift. It's a long road ahead, and man and beast must reach the end with the strength to fight. Little hobbits do not belong in war, Master Meriadoc.
All my friends have gone to battle. I would be ashamed to be left behind.
It is a 3-day gallop to Minas Tirith, and none of my riders can bear you as a burden.
I want to fight.
I will say no more.
So this poor fellow, he really wants to fight, but he's not very competent. So he's left behind, except he isn't. You know, and then he plays an incredibly vital role at the end. So those of you who don't know Lord of the Rings world, these little guys are hobbits, and these are men, and then there are elves that are, like, really powerful. Although for some reason in the movie they're sort of portrayed as effeminate, but in the book they're not. They're really awesome. Anyway, So we didn't want our ministry to be too elitist. And you know, a college ministry, you have to play sports and be fun and so this is how we develop these ministries. And in our Inner High ministry, it's mostly language speaking churches where you'll have a Korean church or a Cambodian church or a Vietnamese church, and the second generation don't speak the language and are kind of embarrassed by their parents' culture, and they get dragged to church. And so we go there and we send them out in teams, and it's a really sweet ministry. And then we gather them region-wide for retreats in the summer and the winter, and then the elderly care home. And these ministries aren't sort of minimal involvement kind of ministries. I mean, we're bringing a full sermon and music and the entire program. People get together and come up with message series. They do dry runs. You know, we try to really honor the elderly and the small little youth groups with high quality stuff. And then, final passage from the Book of Acts. And you guys know this. There arose on that day great persecution against the church in Jerusalem. And they were all scattered throughout the regions of Judea and Samaria, except the apostles. Now those who were scattered went about preaching the word. Now those who were scattered because of the persecution that arose over Stephen traveled as far as Phoenicia and Cyprus and Antioch, speaking the word to no one except Jews. But there were some men, some of them. I still have my NIV interference going on. There were some of them, men of Cyprus and Cyrene, who on coming to Antioch spoke to the Hellenists, also preaching the Lord Jesus, and the hand of the Lord was with them, and a great number who believed turned to the Lord. So we know this to be the Antioch church, and it's funny, there's I don't know if I should tell this story. I will. So you know how they spoke to no one except the Jews. So I have a confession to make. We would get the names of all of the incoming students at Berkeley before they arrived in the summer. and then we would pick out only the Asian names. We would toss out all the Anglo names, and we'd pray just for the Asians. So, and it's not because we didn't like white people. It's because we looked up to white people, and we thought we're hobbits and they're elves and they're not gonna come. And lo and behold, it turns out they're humbler than we thought. So now, outside of California, because a lot of our California schools were actually plurality Asian, the actual population, but outside of California, we're 50% non-Asian at all of our churches. So, you know, that's still a lot of Asians than is typical, but that's encouraging to me. Anyway, so the people who scattered, you know, it was a great tragedy, and I wonder if they were really spooked, and the wonderful church is over, and the dream is gone, and Stefan has died, and it's really inspiring that even though that's the case, that they could not help but to preach the gospel wherever they went. And you know that these unnamed guys, you know, came up with the brilliant idea, like, we should just preach to everybody, right? And so was birthed the Antioch church. And at our church, we don't have a huge distinction between clergy and laity. We really don't. And we don't have a notion that, you know, only full-time vocational ministers should preach, or we don't have any such distinctions. And for example, our University of Chicago church that was planted last year, so they're in their second fall semester right now, started by seven guys, class of 2015. So they're 24, 25-year-old guys. They got jobs out there. They got two apartments in Hyde Park and just started going out to campus, engaging students, and they're now at about 30 students. And three of them, we gave them some training in preaching, and they took turns preaching, and that's how that church was birthed and is going. So we have a culture where everyone sees themselves as being on mission, and I need to reach people. Because if you're in a collegiate setting, like, that's the formative experience. Here's what's true about collegiate ministries. If you blow your freshman outreach for a couple of years, you're extinct. It's over for you. It's a great opportunity because one day, 25% of the campus shows up. But you only have, like, maybe 2 weeks to engage them. Because by that time, everybody's sort of affiliated with their clubs and sense of belonging. So I think that's made us very evangelistic and outreach-oriented. And with that in everybody's heart, just some guys going and planting a church is not only a possibility. That's sort of how they talk, you know, like, hey, let's one of these days, you know, let's go and plant a church together. I think churches, plant churches, not so much gifted. You can tell I have something against gifted people, right? Not so much like strikingly gifted people. I think the leadership gifting required for the main stage of one of our bigger churches is probably like, you know, 1 in 10,000. I mean, I think those gifts are really rare. And but what we've got is guys who've learned to covenant with each other and have seen that, wow, this can continue, right? We have relationships that are measured by decades. And we tell these stories, like, we met when we were freshmen and we thought we'd never be friends. And look at us now. And that becomes a part of the realm of possibility for them. And if they go, then it's a group who already are a church. You know, they're going to plant a church, but they already are a church. And when we move to another college town, we're inviting them to sort of join us. So I think our discipleship philosophy, if we had one, would be, wouldn't be like, you become like me. You know, the one person discipling one person who's going to disciple another person. And I just think that's copy of a copy, and it tends to degrade. Our discipleship idea is, you know, look how happy and how strongly bonded we are, and you guys, you and your friends can become like me and my friends. So when freshmen or sophomores say, hey, we want to be like you guys by hanging out at our apartments, I think that's a huge win. I often wonder what happened to the Jerusalem church. You don't hear much about the Jerusalem church anymore, except a bit in chapter 15. And then the church in Jerusalem council in chapter 15, it's like institutionally strong, you know, but all of the vitality of Acts 2 seems to have been drained away from them. And it seems like things started sort of exploding at the Antioch church, and the spiritual center of gravity moves to the Antioch church. And I don't want to be the Jerusalem church. And I read in Jeff's book that we're all the Jerusalem church, or kidding ourselves if we're not. He said the life cycle of a church, that was sobering reading. And I know that we're not the exception. So before the decline, the inevitable decline, which maybe we can forestall by a little bit, I want to send out as many teams as possible. And I fully expect and hope that the Antioch church will be out there somewhere, out at the margins, where some men keep preaching the gospel. So in 2017, we sent out 150 people to five cities in the East Coast. And I wasn't sure if we were going to survive that. And so I used language like, we're blowing up our church and it'll be okay. And but I just felt like, you know, that many people were ready to go. In fact, 430 some people signed up to go. So we had to go on a mad search for more campuses. So we're at Pittsburgh, at Carnegie Mellon and UPID and Rutgers and George Mason in Virginia, UMD in Maryland, and UNC in North Carolina. And, you know, everybody's from the West Coast, you know, and we sort of hurled them out there, and they haven't died, and they're in their third year, and they're doing okay. You know, we don't thrive, but we can survive. And if we survive and we grow slowly, still after 4 years, you know, people keep joining. And so one of the big question mark that I have is, okay, so all these people are joining, and there's only so many Inter-High and ECM ministries. Like, so people are gathering at the end of the four-year college experience, and they're joining us with deep rootedness in our culture. What's next? You know, and that's something that we're grappling with. So that's all I have. Thank you.
So we're going to have some Q's and hear some A's. And but before we do, I just want to kind of serve up a couple of thoughts or questions to you. So you were describing, Ed, that this culture that is Acts 2-esque, and this no needy person amongst you, this sacrificial giving away, and it is so countercultural to the way the church is in North America. In fact, I remember I had a professor in university, a Greek New Testament Southern Baptist professor, who, when he talked about the famine in Jerusalem and Paul taking the offering going there, said the reason that happened was because the Jerusalem church turned communistic and gave away all their good things. And just
what a message for today.
Oh,
huh?
Yeah. I mean, so
with socialism back on the agenda.
But I mean, the Christian church is so inculcated with that idea of property rights and all these kinds of things. And you're living something that is kingdom-esque and looks so different. Do you get called a cult? Do people call you, think that this is a weird thing?
I mean, not straight up cult, but cultic, a lot of cultic. And I think it's such an insult to the church, because when somebody's really crazy, then they go, oh, wow, that must be a cult, you know? So why should they have the monopoly on intensity or zeal? So I think it's a great insult to the church. So it's not socialism. I think socialism is utopian and stupid. So it's not socialism. What it is it's family, right? It's family because, you know, if you have a really good family, right? Like one uncle can't have like a Mercedes and a Tesla, while like another family, like they don't have money for shoes for their kids. Like, that just wouldn't happen in a normal family, right? So I think the sharing is not institutional or programmatic. It's very relational. And we have stories of guys giving cars to people who need it, and sharing homes, and people staying rent-free because they're financially tight, or envelopes slipped under the door anonymously. I mean, we have stories like that all the time, and it's all in the context of relationships and love. So,
and I've had the privilege of getting a little peek under the of the sweet, sweet nature of the fellowship that God has blessed you and your leadership to just build throughout that whole church. And it is sweet. It's something that you don't get to see often. Let people get a picture of how evangelistically effective things are in what you're doing. So what percentage of your church came to your church outside of a relationship with Christ?
So we have we actually tallied this up, and the accurate number is 76% of our people became Christian at our church. So we
That's
have
slightly above normal.
So we have about 1,300 people that we call staff, and I recognize that's not how the word staff is used elsewhere, but for us, staff is people who have bought in fully, you know, and see themselves as ministers. And they're all engaged in this kind of ministry, and in that number, it was 76%.
All right. So let's just take some questions from the floor here. And
can you explain some of the practicalities of the ask when you're asking students to consider before the Lord to stick around? That doesn't happen in May, the week before graduation. So leading up to, how long leading up to it are you casting vision, telling them what they'll be doing or what they can be doing? What does that look like?
There are two levels at which I can answer that. One is we start that around March, and we send out a survey. Are you planning on staying, and which ministry do you want to be a part of? And there's application process. What actually happens is they start talking about it early on, and it's pretty clear. So when the culture gets going, it's surprising how many things we don't need to talk about anymore. In the early days, it was ugly. And it was ugly because we didn't ask. We just like, what, you're not staying? You know, we got wounded, and peers would have dramatic conversations with each other. And we just said, no. I mean, let them leave in peace. Bless them. So we needed to go through that period, you know. But there's a political science professor from Harvard who wrote a book called Exodus and Revolution, I found really fascinating, in which he talks about, you know, that incident where they put on swords and they kill their brothers, the Levites. And it talks about that the early inception of any revolutionary movement, there's a vanguard, and they need to sort of purge the ranks. And I'm saying this kind of jokingly, so don't take me too seriously. But so there was a period when the culture wasn't established where that was a little messy. And even, am I going to make college ministry or not, before we had all of these ministries? And if you didn't, then it's like not making the team. You know, so there were those rougher, kind of painful periods as well. But nowadays, by spring break, you know, they know, or we talk to them about it.
Any other questions? Do you send everybody? So everybody who says, I want to be a church planter, do you send them all?
Pretty much, unless we see some serious problems. Because they're already on team and they've served kind of faithfully. I guess, pretty much everybody. Okay. Yeah.
Ed, can you talk about the relationship with other collegiate ministries? What about the relationship to other collegiate ministries, and how do you navigate that?
Within our own campuses where we are, it all sort of differs. There are certain settings in which it's really collegial because there's somebody there that brings all the ministers together. In certain campuses, it's a lot more siloed. We have a good relationship with other collegiate church planting churches. So we have a network that I enjoy very much. So I'm always inviting them to come to Berkeley, you know, or UCLA or any of our campuses. that will set up a student group for you and things like that. So I'm very open to other groups. I think the college campuses are underserved. But relationship with other campus groups. So I'm a little, we're not really great at working together and collaborating because we're so busy trying to reach. So here's the thing. I it's hard to say this without sounding disrespectful to other collegiate ministries, but this is how I see it. Is a lot of them are not involved in very like going after unchurched kids, and we are, and it takes a lot of energy and a lot of time. I mean, you have to pour in a whole lot to just get. So a lot of collegiate ministries tend to be places where you bring in the well-churched and disciple them, and you know, God bless them for doing that. So then our rhythms and sort of our approaches tend not to be very, very similar. So, yeah, I think the question over there.
Yeah, so I was curious about the funding mechanisms for this. Is this kind of pragmatic based on what's needed for the site? Hey, we've got COVO, BIVO over here. We've got, partnership support teams. How does that work?
So we fund everything internally, and we've discovered that the churches are self-sufficient almost right away. So usually the teams are led by one full-time couple that who's had a long sort of track record as a COVO leader, and then when they go out to plant and lead a team, that's when they go full-time. We pay their salary, but there's usually 10 people working in tithing at least. And so after the band equipment and the speakers and everything are purchased for them, and there's a startup fund of about $50,000, they never need to draw on it anymore.
Mm-hmm. Ed, I got a question. What is a week in the life, or like the rhythm of one of your guys that goes to start, a couple that starts, like what does that look like for them in a week?
So Monday is Sabbath, so no emails, no texting, everybody chill out, calm down, have family night. And then it sort of varies, but generally it goes something like Tuesday, there's usually a campus prayer meeting. And then Wednesday, they will go out to put on some evangelistic outreach of some sort, either going to the dining halls to just do one-on-one evangelism, or, you know, they developed all these creative little ways, setting up lights and do perspective cards and things like that. So Wednesdays, they'll do that. Thursday, we call our staff soul care night, where they hang out, and they'll have dinner together, and they'll read or, sort of wait for their souls to catch up. And then Friday generally is our Bible study on campus. So that's sort of a big event. And then Sunday, of course, we put on Sunday. So that's sort of the rhythm.
Maybe give people a look, because Sunday doesn't look like most people's Sunday. Like, describe what happens at Berkeley.
Yeah, so Sunday we have our service at 9 a.m. and 4 p.m., same service twice for all of our post-college crowd, so that they can leave for their ministries and blessing all these other churches. So then we hold our service times in non-optimal hours so that we can release them for that. And then out in Berkeley, we have three services for college students. So it's a pretty tiring day, Sunday. And we set everything up, so we're church on wheels. And in addition to their ministries, a lot of what we do is, you know, radical sharing of our most precious resource, which is time and energy, to enable everybody to do ministry together. So we have, probably one of the most unique aspects of our church is husbands and wives are in the ministry together every step of the way, every inch of it. So that means that childcare is a big issue. We don't want the arrival of children to take the sisters out of ministry, because then the guys are doing ministry with other single women or something like that. And then it provides a wedge, like you're in different worlds. And so just somehow we figured out that we can pair people up and have people who are maybe time and energy rich provide it for the young harried couples so that they can stay engaged in ministry. And couples ministering together is huge for college students who come from broken homes and things like that. So there's a lot of that actually plays into our weekly rhythm as well. A lot of different rotations and different ways that people help each other out.
Maybe one more question?
Kind of a two-part question. One is, it seems like you've got a surge you have to have at the first of a semester, because you spoke about the 2 to 3 weeks a month that you really have where they're kind of wet cement. So when a team hits the ground, they have to build a strategy for how they're going to get traction quickly, because it's kind of like the Oregon Trail. Once you get on it, you're on it for a year. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that as kind of the first part of the question?
Yeah, so our strategy in the first 2 weeks of fall, or maybe 1 month of fall, is to do a lot of attractional events. So when a new team gets out there, they need help to put that on. So we'll have a lot of people go and provide that help. And at Berkeley, I think we grill 2,000 pounds of meat, high-quality meat, too, because way to a college student's heart is through their stomach. So there's a lot of heavy logistics and a lot of food and a lot of fun, attractional events, and we create a big pool from which we invite them to, like, a small group or to our Bible study. So,
and then how do you follow up to provide care and support for that team? I mean, what's your coaching network or mechanism for that?
Frequent getting together. All of our team leads get together once a month. We fly them all back to Berkeley, and we decided, man, if we're going to stay together, and not allow the distance to kind of degrade our relationships, we can't be cheap about airfare. So we decided, no, we're going to put in the time to get together a lot. For the rest of the team members, they get together by regions. And then every year, everybody comes back. So this year, I think we're expecting 1,600 people back in Berkeley. And it's about a five-day affair between Christmas and New Year's, where it's like you grow hoarse the first 2 hours. Everybody shouting and hugging each other, and so that's probably so that's one way. But as we scale, we're gonna have to get regional or something sad like that. But for now, that's what we're doing. Yeah.
So let me just ask, because I have two more questions. I'm just gonna throw more light on, and then we'll let you go. But so when we think of collegiate church planting, I mean, anybody's brain goes to, it's going to be poor, there's not going to be any resources, and but you are doing this with a mindset of the vast majority of your team is co-vocational, and so when you go and you plant you actually buy a resort property juxtaposed to places where you're planting. Why do you do that?
So it's not a resort, but
pretty nice.
We don't believe in getting buildings, because I think buildings sort of end up defining what you're going to do, and your ministry turns into like, hey, what can we do in this building? But we get vacation homes because the students are on the computer too much anyway. We need to get them out into nature. And so we actually built a retreat site and bought a beautiful home in Yosemite and Monterey in California. And then we have two homes right on the Potomac on the East Coast within maximum four-hour drive of all of our churches. And so and the reason we do that is I think just getting away for a weekend with college students and having fun and doing Bible together, it just accelerates ministry a whole lot. And it enhances the bonding of our own staff team too. So
that's a picture I just want you to get. Like, what these guys are being very intentional in everything that they're doing. And let me just ask one last question. You and Kelly, what are your kids doing?
So going back a little bit to the earlier question about being poor, we were poor as a church, and then suddenly we weren't. It's like suddenly, like, oh my gosh, we have money. I worked as a lawyer. Kelly worked as a programmer long after I became full-time, because my first full-time salary was $200 a month. So everybody did ministry out of their own pocket, and whatever the church needed, we bought it. But then at a certain tipping point, and it came pretty early, I think, you know, everybody has ownership so that they're tithing and using their money to feed the college students and buying pizza for them. And so if you wait a little bit, because I think collegiate ministry is not a niche. Like, it is a niche ministry that people don't like. Oh, okay, Crew and InterVarsity, and they have that. But I just feel like it's actually an ideal place to plant a church, even if you're not going to stay focused on college like we have. You just have to wait 4 or 5 years and love them, and you'll have an army of kingdom workers. My kids, so we have five couples on deck to go out in 2020, and my oldest son and my grandson. I just got a grandson a year ago, and it's just amazing. But they're on deck to go out, so we're probably going to, we're thinking of Purdue, Johns Hopkins, maybe Georgia Tech, Emory. We're thinking of those campuses, so they're going to go out this coming spring. My second and third, Noah and Anna, they're both single, and they're out at Hyde Park doing UChicago ministry. They have no connection to Chicago. It's just that was a year that Noah's friends wanted to go, and Anna joined them, and so they're there. So me and Kelly, we joke, man, we broke a lot of parents and grandparents' hearts by sending out these people, so it's our turn. So it's all fair. It's okay.
That's right. So I know you guys want to give them a big thanks, big hand, but thanks so much for coming, yeah, brother. Yep. Do we have any announcements? Okay, here's Dick.
Fantastic. Okay, so we're back here tomorrow in the morning at 8:30 a.m. So, yeah, that's it. Have a great evening. Awesome morning. We'll see you all tomorrow.
I've worn shadows.